Hello, Internet family. This is Anjanette Potter, also known as Adams Red, and you are listening to the Smart Black Girls Club podcast. So today's topic is going to be hip-hop feminism. And right after I discuss that, I will be talking about feminist activism in hip-hop. So like I said, you know, even though I'm a big fan of hip-hop, I'm a fan of rap music, I go back to the Sugar Hill Gang, Rapper's Delight. So this is a musical genre that I am a day one with. This Friday night at midnight, I will be doing Eclectic Weekends, and I will be honoring Christian hip-hop, Christianity and hip-hop. There's been a little bit of criticism when it comes to that, because there are people who feel like, well, you know, it's secular music and you're trying to make it divine. I remember one of the elderly gentlemen in a church I used to go to basically felt like you can't, you know, it's hot goods because their gifts came from the church. And now here you are out in the world taking your gifts and using them to glorify things other than God. So if you remember seeing Jamie Foxx's biopic, Ray, you probably remember church people coming into the club where Ray was performing and basically talking about how he was doing the devil's music. And, you know, they recognized one of the songs that he was doing as a gospel song that he turned into a secular song. And so, you know, they showed up and they were like, that's wrong what you're doing. That's sacrilegious. That's of the devil. As a now born again Christian, back when I was of the world, I probably wouldn't have thought nothing of it because I was of the world. But in the early days of rock and roll, in the early days of rock, there was a lot of that because most musicians were raised in church. And so there was the belief that you should be taking your giftings and using them to sing gospel music, to make music as unto the Lord. And, you know, they were very, very devout about not using your giftings to glorify the flesh. So, I remember when a few contemporary gospel artists came out, especially B.B. and C.C. Winans, there was also a whole lot of criticism because people thought that it didn't sound gospel enough. So, you know, and there was the same criticism with Christian hip-hop. So I'll be talking about it a little bit more this Friday. So right now I want to talk about hip-hop feminism. So let me go ahead and, you know, like I said, information is courtesy of Wikipedia, you know, citing sources. So hip-hop feminism is a subset of Black feminism that centers on intersectional subject positions involving race and gender in a way that acknowledges the contradictions in being a Black feminist, such as Black women's enjoyment in hip-hop music and culture, rather than simply focusing on the victimization of Black women in hip-hop culture due to interlocking systems of oppression involving race, class, and gender. The term was coined by the American author Joan Morgan in her book, When Chicken Heads Come Home to Roost. A hip-hop feminist breaks it down for Black women who grew up in the post-civil rights movement and feminist movement of the 60s and 70s. So Morgan explains that hip-hop feminist is a self-defined name for Black feminists that acknowledge Black women's lived experiences as they identify and enjoy hip-hop culture along with supporting feminist issues and agendas where Black women are marginalized by the mainstream feminist movement because of their race or the Black anti-racist movements due to their gender. So hip-hop feminism has various definitions and scholarly inventions to help understand how hip-hop sensibilities influence not only music, but also different forms of Black expression, as well as feminist and anti-racist social movements. So in When Chicken Heads Come to Roost, I'm going to have to get this. A hip-hop feminist breaks it down. Morgan explains that she coined the term hip-hop feminism because she was unable to fully identify with feminism without acknowledging and embracing her enjoyment and misogynistic hip-hop music and elements of patriarchy. So Ms. Morgan explains that the term hip-hop feminism is used to express the ambiguities and contradictions of being a Black feminist who still enjoys certain aspects of patriarchal and misogynistic society. Lord have mercy. Such as enjoying hip-hop music that reaffirms rather than challenges misogyny, which she calls effing with the grays. So this is another book, The Stage Hip-Hop Feminism Built, A New Directions Essay. Aisha Durham, Brittany Cooper, and Susanna M. Morris define hip-hop feminism as a form of Black feminism that is rooted in the lived experience of Black feminists and members of the African diaspora, along with the political prerogatives, and aesthetics of hip-hop culture that builds on previous Black feminist thought. They also stress the importance of Black women and girls, as well as women and girls of color, remaining central within analysis of hip-hop culture. So hip-hop feminism acknowledges the problematic misogynistic nature of the culture and its formative effects on young Black women and empowers them by enabling participation, response, and owning self-identification. Further, it aims to affirm Black women and girls' lived experiences and contributions to hip-hop culture, such as Double Dutch, childhood chants, and twerking, that are less culturally recognizable in comparison to more traditional and masculine forms of expression in hip-hop culture, such as emceeing, DJing, graffiti, and b-boying and b-girling. It can also provide a more gender-inclusive study of Black women and queer folks' involvement and expression in hip-hop culture, rather than focusing on cisgender boys and men as hip-hop subjects. So, as I talk more about different categories when it comes to feminism, when it comes to women's participation in certain genres, like I said before, though I'm celebrating the 50 years of hip-hop, I'm also talking about some of the problematic themes in hip-hop that need to be addressed. And to be perfectly honest with you, also the business side. Like, you see a lot of not only problematic behavior, men who are, sexual issues of sexual harassment, sexual assault, and abusive behavior, and the tendency of people to look the other way when, bad things are happening, when negative things are happening, especially to women and girls. So right now I'm going to talk a little bit about misogyny and social change. And also even more problematic behavior, because we're talking about Black folks. We're talking about a medium that is largely Black. The issue of colorism and the issue of the issue of representation of women that are not only darker than a paper bag, but also fuller figure. And the fact that you have people who think, have used the excuse that women darker than a paper bag aren't marketable. The emphasis on beauty. A man can weigh 300 pounds and still, be respected in many industries, but let a woman be bigger than a size 12, and we get all kinds of issues. I can remember someone saying a while back how Kiki Wyatt, the R&B singer, was oppressed by darker skinned people when she was younger. And so I was like, well, that's a hard, like when I hear a light-skinned person talk about how they were oppressed, I kind of have to raise my eyebrows, because colorism is really about your proximity to whiteness. Now, I'm not going to say that, they were not bullied, that they weren't picked on, that, people didn't misbehave toward them because of their color, because, everybody experiences some negativity when it comes to some aspect about themselves that some people don't agree with. However, I have a hard time saying oppressed, because oppressed usually has to do with limiting your ability to succeed. As far as that is concerned, if you've been able to go somewhere else and be able to just like, to me, that's like white people talking about reverse racism. You may have ran into some Black people that were prejudiced, that were bigoted toward white people, and they exist. However, that Black person hasn't been able to establish a systematic way of keeping you out of anything. So that's the difference between, and it's the same with sexism. Men can talk about reverse sexism, but there's been no system erected against you unless you're a man of color. There's been no system that has been erected against you that has, moved to keep you out of certain circles. You're not being kept out of things, that you're not being roadblocked, you're not being blackballed, you're not being kept out of things. Nobody has built a college and told you that you couldn't come and study the career of your choice. Okay? No one has caused you to have to go and build an institution of your own in order to be able to do what you want for a living or study what you want. No one has caused you to have to go and create a record label of your own just so that you get your music out. Okay? Now, you may have experienced that as a man if you're a man of color. But, no one has caused you to have to go and find another way to do what you need to do. If you're still able to operate within the system, then you're not truly oppressed, like I said, I'm not going to knock down your lived experience, okay? Because you may have experienced somebody being a bigot towards you or bullying you, you know, and but it's really not the same as being oppressed. So hip-hop and music videos as mediums easily spread throughout the internet, mass media, and popular culture are perfect, you know, those are perfect, you know, platforms for motivating social change. It can also be used to recognize intersects between communities. Rebecca explains the way in which creative mediums such as hip-hop can be used to wreck the interlocking systems of oppression in America. The point is to offer women of the hip-hop generation feminist and womanist alternatives to the patriarchal misrepresentations of womanhood spewing out of the U.S. culture industries. Whether they meant to or not, the women of the hip-hop generation have created a body of work that offers up feminist or womanist answers to many of the hip-hop generation's most urgent interpersonal cultural and political issues. And recent feminist scholars have suggested that in its own controversial or contradictory way, the hip-hop feminist movement may well have been the most politically polyvocal, which means many voices, socially visible manifestation of the ongoing evolution of the women's liberation movement, prevalent in contemporary U.S. society. Hip-hop feminism can be situated within Afrofuturism. So let me go into Afrofuturism to see. So Afrofuturism is a cultural aesthetic philosophy of science and history that explores the intersection of the African diaspora culture with science and technology. It addresses themes of and concerns of the African diaspora through technoculture and speculative fiction, encompassing a range of media and artists with shared interests in envisioning Black cultures, Black futures that stem with Afro-diasporic experiences. So while African futurism is commonly associated with science fiction, it also can encompass other speculative genres such as fantasy, alternate history, and magic realism. So this is a term that was coined by someone named Mark Derry, an American cultural critic in 1993. And explored in the late 90s through conversations led by Alondra Nelson. So they just gave me another topic to talk about this year. So let me see here. So what they're saying is hip-hop feminism can be situated within Afrofuturism to understand how hip-hop feminism operates both within and outside academia, as well as examine and critique the marginalized experience of Black people throughout time. So I'm going to go into another book, and Growing Up Where No One Looked Like Me, Race, Gender, Race, Hip Hop, and Identity in Vancouver. So this is, you know, Vancouver is a province out of Canada. Jillian Kreese uses interviews from second-generation African-Canadian men and women and their analysis of how the social-cultural understanding of Blackness and hip-hop influenced the experiences of African-Canadian youth growing up in communities where they were one of the few African-American children in the community. So I've been going through a little thing. I kind of understand that. I've been going through a thing where there have been people trying to convince me that they could trade me to white people. So I have a little problem with that whole thing. And one of the things that I feel like there's a problem with is there's not only one way to be black. So I feel for those. I can remember, you know, because a lot of people will try to tell you, well, you're used to them. And it's like, you know, you're talking about somebody who is trying to navigate their way through a situation that they didn't choose. I can remember when I was younger, growing up, living with my grandmother. My first school that I went to in Massillon, Ohio, was a school called Horace Mann. Now, Horace Mann was, you know, predominantly white, but they, you know, we're talking about a working class neighborhood that was pretty racially mixed. There was a lot, you know, there, you know, compared to a lot of other neighborhoods in Massillon, there was a lot of black kids. One family, there was a lot of biracial children. And so once they decided to close that school down, I basically got bused to a school that was predominantly white, which means when I first started going there, me and one of my cousins started going there. They put her in a separate class because this school was kind of large enough that they had more than one of each grade. So they had more than one kindergarten. They had two kindergartens, basically all the way up through sixth grade. They were K through six. And each of the grades that they had more than one classroom for that grade. So it was a pretty decent sized school. And I think I was one of two black people in my entire class. Now, for people who, well, wasn't it a better school? The building was probably better. You know, when you're talking about school systems like that, where, you know, that this is one of the reasons why black people have the term white privilege. Because when you're going somewhere where, you know, the people are a little bit wealthier, they have more money, so they can afford to pay more taxes to be able to make their schools look better and have, you know, better access to educational resources, you know, computers in the class, different, you know, they can afford for the schools to be built like spaceships and have all kind of stuff going on. Now, of course, this wasn't going on when I was younger because many of the things that they were doing in classrooms now, they weren't doing back then. But we were able to have newer books, cleaner classrooms, like just all kinds of stuff. So when you think about that, and you think about, yeah, from that standpoint, it's a better school. But is it better for your children emotionally? Are they picked on because they're different? Because, you know, every story where they have gone somewhere where they were, you know, quote, not welcome, there's always been the issue of their emotional well-being. Are they being picked on because they're the only one or two black people in the class? And a lot of people don't like to recognize that bullying happens in white schools too. And it happens against black kids. Okay? And it happens to us no matter what shade we are. The isolation that many kids face. Okay, I was looking at an old episode of Facts of Life. And, you know, most of you know Kim Fields, who played Tootie. So, of course, when we were looking at it at the time, we weren't thinking about the fact that Tootie's the only black kid in this, you know, seemed to be the only black kid in the entire cast. Okay? So for those of you who don't know, Facts of Life was a spinoff from a Different Strokes, from Different Strokes. And so Miss Garrett was the maid or housekeeper for Mr. Drummond. And so she began to be so popular that they spun off a show for her where she was over a girls' school. And it was the girls' school that was attended by Kimberly Drummond, the daughter. And so I remember when they first started it, you know, they had Kim Fields in roller skates because she was really short. But in that entire, I'm like, you mean to tell me, like now I can look at it and say, you mean to tell me, even in the beginning stages of it, Facts of Life, Tootie was the only black person, Kim Fields was the only black actress in the entire class. Now, I recognize some of the girls from other, I think the new Mickey Mouse Club or whatever. So this was like the second, not the one with Justin Timberlake and Britney Spears. There was an earlier formation of them. And so this would have been the second formation of the Mickey Mouse Club. So it wasn't the black and white ones either, because I would have been too young to be able to watch those. So in the beginning, like they had a larger class, they had a larger cast. And I remember Molly Ringwald from that show, as well as others. Well, if those of us who are true blue fans of the show know that after a while, they began to thin the herd. You know, they started focusing on the lineup that they wound up ending the show with. And that was Natalie, Blair, Joe, and Kim Fields. So there was about, they thinned all the way down to about four or five girls and Mrs. Garrett. And I think she transferred to another school and they wound up going with her. Anyway, now that I've given you that much background, now that I have gone into that much background, they thinned it down. They never seemed to bring any other black actresses on there. And not to speak for, you know, I'm sure, you know, Miss Fields was lucky, felt lucky to have that role. So I'm not going to sit over here and talk about that. But the episode that I was looking at was an episode where a black boy showed up that, you know, developed an interest in her romantically. And so he was basically kind of making her feel like she wasn't black enough. And, you know, and was basically, you know, bagging on her because of her relationship to the other girls, because she was going to be in a dance contest with a white boy. And so I am going to do an episode on the term Oreo sometime next week. Probably Tuesday or Wednesday, I'm going to talk about the term Oreo and why it has racist connotations and why, as a black person, you shouldn't say it. But, you know, but it was just one of those things where he was basically kind of shaming her. And I have seen episodes like this in episodic TV before, and I've always kind of been, why does the black person who comes in and challenge whatever's there? And what I thought was, and challenge whatever is there, viewed as a troublemaker. Right. They're always, you know, a troublemaker. They're never just speaking their mind or saying to the person, you know, what they're observing. They're always, you know, an antagonist and always there to upset the apple cart of the main characters, because I think that Everybody Hates Chris kind of examined that same thing. Chris, you know, another black kid showed up and kind of seemed to be upsetting Chris and Greg's friendship. And even though Everybody Hates Chris had pretty much a whole cast, you know, a larger cast of black people, they still kind of tend to write that character as a bit of a troublemaker. And I'll talk about that another time too. So I was like, but one thing I noticed and I thought kind of gave me a chuckle was Tootie felt pressured to go out and make some black friends, which I'm like, okay, you know, she met these black girls, they came and they sat and entertained and talked amongst each other and this, that, and the other. And of course she wasn't as tight with them as she was with the other girls because she had more time to form bonds and be friends with them, and especially Natalie, who was her best friend. And I said, what I think is funny is, you know, they brought these girls in. Of course, you know, they lasted that episode and we never saw them little black girls again. It was like, you know, that was the thing about Eastland to me and the other subsequent school, that I was just like, you know, can we get some more color? Can we at least see some kids walking around campus or doing something? But that's what happens when you're 56 and you watch shows that you watched when you were younger and never really thought nothing of it. And so, you know, that's what this makes me think of when they're talking about interviewing, you know, African Canadian men and, you know, the social understanding, the social cultural understanding of blackness and hip hop influence. You know, you think you're doing a good thing by taking them to a school where they won't have the quote unquote influences that they would have if they stayed in the inner city or in a neighborhood where there might be a little more crime. You know, and like I said, yeah, you know, they have more resources, they have more to do, but it's like, you know, most of the kids, and I can say the same thing about myself, felt a bit isolated. It can feel very isolated. You know, you could have a lot of good white friends, but there's something about being able to be around your peers or who you view to be your peers, is very isolating. And it's something that I think that, you know, a lot of parents should consider when they're talking about what school to send your, you know, children to. So Kreese found that back to the article that I'm reading. Kreese found that black African Canadian men's experience differed from black African Canadian women's experience because of how hip hop and youth allows black men to be seen as cool black and have an easier time connecting and being popular in school due to the cultural view of black masculinity as cool, in comparison to the lack of cool black femininity in hip-hop culture, where culturally black women are seen as hypersexualized, exotic, or whitewashed version of black femininity. In 1992, Mary J. Blige released What's the 411 on Uptown MCA Records, and was considered the pioneer of hip-hop feminism. Well, they called her the queen of hip-hop soul. If you look in my life, love, hip-hop, soul, and contemporary African-American womanhood, which is a book. Author Trevor B. Lindsay documents Blige's diverse musical influences and claims that these diverse influences sparked a sonic innovation that created a unique space for African-American storytelling, African-American women's storytelling, and narrative, and read articles of love in contemporary black womanhood. What's the 411 was groundbreaking. given its success, and it permitted Miss Blige's entry into a musical arena mostly regulated and mediated by men. Lindsay further claims that by crafting women-authored narratives and performing women-centered hip-hop storytelling, artists such as Blige prove that the voices of black women hip-hop soul singers create a distinctly hip-hop feminist space within a male-dominated soundscape. Yeah, because one of the things I noticed when I was gathering up music for the Christian hip-hop show that I'm going to be doing Friday, and if you're going to be watching this on YouTube, it's going to be past Friday, was the female artists seem to be really, really incredibly underrepresented. And to be honest with you, you know, they're getting to be way more represented within secular hip hop, but I didn't see no female hip hop artists, female hip hop artists represented in Christian hip hop. Just a little something to throw out there. So behind Queen Latifah, such artists created a distinct space within, you know, hip hop for explorations of African American womanhood, and dynamically brought into light issues of representation in narratives and stories. So behind Queen Latifah came artist Lauryn Hill, who became the best example of hip hop feminism with record-breaking sales of Miseducation of Lauryn Hill, a classic. Both good artists and both people, women that I like a lot. And she won 5 Grammy Awards back in 1998. Artists such as Latifah. Now, Latifah, her message I really like because it was decidedly at least womanist, because it spoke of empowering, you know, sizing up men by their character. UNITY is one of my favorites. It ministers to me whenever I'm having a day where men have gotten on my nerves. And not just by being men, but... Unknown caller. Okay, sorry about that. A little bit of interruption. Satan is definitely on his thing. But, So for me, like a lot of her stuff had a feminist edge, or at least a womanist or female empowering edge, because it was created to strengthen women, and especially black women. Lauryn Hill, I also loved because, you know, and other than just being a phenomenal singer, you know, the fact that she was able to do double duty as a hip hop artist. I liked Miseducation of Lauryn Hill because it basically, you know, talked about the pain. You know, it was one of those things I always call music like that, music that sings the secret counsel of women's hearts. The Fugees were an important part of the neo-soul, as well as being hip-hop artists, I consider them to be part of the neo-soul movement. So, you know, talking about, you know, different issues that pertain to women, what, you know, forms a lot of our stances in life. Forms our stances in life, forms our opinions in life, the pain that goes into creating us sometimes. And, you know, it was a very good album. Let me see here. So, I don't know if I agree with this statement, but Artists such as Latifah and Hill mimicked the hip-hop rhetoric of males in the scene and created a massive amount of attention. Missy Elliott was often seen dressed in similar, I think she just was wearing what made her comfortable, to be perfectly honest with you, but dressed similar to male hip-hop artists and utilized the same body language and aggressive delivery of her lyrics as a means of protest while still preserving her femininity. Even after losing weight over the years, she made sure while performing videos that the cameras were face to her face and dancing. So you have two, I'm going to say this, you have two different stances going on here. And like everything else, the feminist movement is not full of people who agree 100%. And you will find, you will hear that when I talk about feminism and sex work. Because, you know, I'm personally anti-sex work. I'm not in favor of it. And I can, and I'll give you the reasons why when I talk about that, which may be next week. But, you know, as we come, you know, it seemed like we, when we started off with women in hip hop, we were wearing more clothing and downplaying our sexuality in order to be taken seriously by the males, by the men in the industry. So, right, people talk about, you know, the article is now talking about Nicki Minaj. But before Nicki Minaj came along, there was Lil' Kim and Foxy Brown. So Lil' Kim and Foxy Brown came along, and it just, and you know, it's like they did a little bit of a tilt, and then female sexuality was now celebrated. No, you know, women liking to get their swerve on, women liking to get together with men they think are good looking and hook up, began to be imputed in their dress, their manner of dress, was celebrated, and it became a thing of using their sexuality, not necessarily, you know, in a Jezebel like manner, but being empowered by acknowledging that they liked being sexual human beings. And, you know, like I said, I thought that was interesting. Both of them are two, even though I'm not a you know, I'm kind of old school. I'm not the person who believes, you know, I'm not a prude. And like I've said that to people before, I'm not a prude. Like I always wore whatever I felt like made me feel attractive. So, and being a woman who had curves when I was younger, and was boobalicious, basically the outside was one thing, but the inside was very bookish, very nerdy, liked reading, liked, you know, was a very deep thinker about the things that I was reading. And so I was a bit of an odd mix because you have, you know, especially when you're talking about guys, you have dudes who look at you and, you know, fantasize about you and think about getting with you. But then you turn around and you say something smart and all of a sudden you become a know-it-all. So I was just different. And not to say that women, and I think a lot of that has to do with women acknowledging, well, we can be attractive and still be smart. You know what I'm saying? I did a blog post one time, and I think it was in my sex, food, and family blog. And I talked about the whole whether or not nudity is empowering. Right? Because, you know, you have one hand where women talk about, well, you know, you're showing off the goods and it makes women not take us seriously and blah, blah, blah. But then you also have, I remember talking about Demi Moore, Rumor Willis's mama, for those of you who are fans of her children, and how she did a nude picture on the front of a magazine in the 80s. And she was, I would say, third trimester. So she was, you know, at that stage where we start feeling like we were pregnant forever. And I think I was a couple of weeks away from being saved. And so this woman, one of my older hairdresser co-workers, who I think she was about 47 at the time, well, she was in her 40s. She was about as old as my mother. And so she said, "Do you really think that's flattering?" And I said, I think it's cool. Like, I never had, you know, I've never posed nude myself, but I have not approved. Like, I think that there is a time for nudity to be empowering, you know, especially, I'm like, she did something that had never been done before. It really had to do with, can you be almost 9 months pregnant and still be thought of as beautiful or attractive? It was tastefully done. You know, it wasn't porn. It wasn't, you know, anything like that. Now, when you talk about nudity, when it comes to women of color and Black women, that's where things get a little dicey, because we have racism to deal with. And that's one of the reasons why I'm not a big fan of what they call the divest movement. I think that there are a lot of racial undertones there. You know, not everybody that's dating interracially is doing so because they feel, you know, because of the freedom of being able to date who they want. I was talking about following this one YouTuber who talked about interracial marriage and dating in Brazil, and how much of it is grounded and rooted in racism, because you have a lot of Black people that are trying to lighten the skin of the next generation. So you have to really look at your motives for doing things. Like I said, when you talk about nudity for women of color, there is a different thing there, because oftentimes we are fetishized. And so, you know, I've always been the type of person that, okay, let me see here. So let me look, I've already looked at misogyny and social change. So let's talk about, so with this movement came a lot of scholars. I've already mentioned Joan Morgan when chicken heads come home to roost. There's also Seth Cosimini, and you know, that person analyzes the performativity and self-presentation of Nicki Minaj, and how that articulates how women in hip-hop culture may simultaneously challenge and conform to stereotypical representations of femininity. So I think, you know, that's kind of interesting, because there was a time when Nicki Minaj would not have been considered to be feminine, and I'll talk about that in another post. So as explained by Cosimini, Minaj uses contradictory public personas in order to construct a hip-hop identity that recognizes the social oppression driven by race, gender, and sexuality and within and beyond hip-hop culture. Another voice in the movement is Murali Balaji. And this person, because I'm not sure, with some of these names, I'm not sure whether we're talking about a female or male, This person has contributed to existing research on the roles of video vixens in hip hop. He or she also argues that hip hop music video models have the opportunity to utilize a sense of agency in order to negotiate their positions within hip hop culture. Through an analysis of Melissa Ford's music video career, she highlights how it is possible for women in hip hop to harness their sexuality as a form of political resistance. So the video vixen, let's talk about that. So the video vixen, also referred to as hip hop honey or video girl, is a female model who appears in hip hop oriented music videos. So one way that the video vixen label began to be popularized was Corinne Steffens' book, Confessions of a Video Vixen. Now, this is when it helps to be a little older, because you know that the book was a tell-all, and she talked about the sexual activities of many males in the hip-hop world. And so I never read it. But I remember in like the 80s, there was a young lady named Pamela Del Barr who wrote a book called I'm With the Band. And it was a similar type of book where she talked about her sexual exploits with many well-known rockers. And so to me, you know, Corinne Steffens' book was a part two of that. You know, and I thought it was interesting that so many people came for, I don't have one thing or the other against either one of these women. Okay. My upbringing was relatively left-leaning, and so I don't really, you know, even though it's not behavior that I would be indulging in, I don't judge either one of these women for what they were doing, especially with Ms. Steffens, when you hear her backstory. A lot of what she went through as a young woman kind of brought her to the point of, you know, feeling like she had to trade sex for favors, trade sex for being able to be in people's videos. You have women who didn't do that, and it's funny to me when I hear about that whole trade-off, and then I hear other women who distance themselves and go, not everybody was doing that. Those were her choices. And I think about a situation that I just, you know, have been fighting because of sexual harassment. And so it's like, are they really her choices, or are they the choices that she feels like she has to make? Because, you know, I have a saying about men who abuse, and it goes like this. If you are around 100 women and you single out one woman and you sexually abuse her, you are still a sexual abuser. You don't get to get a pass for that one woman by being nice and acting like a gentleman toward every other woman. Now, am I saying that that's what happened to Miss Steffens? Possibility. When you listen to her talk about, you know, how she arrived at that point, you also have to listen about group dynamics. And so where you have groups of men who are on the same mission, you can also have groups of men who get in each other's ear about certain women and decide, this one is going to be our plaything. We're going to be cool with the rest of y'all and treat the rest of you with respect. But we're going to keep this one over here to try to make her into our plaything and kind of bounce her around between us and each other. So you really have to, before you say that that's that woman's choice, you have to think about the amount of freedom that each woman has in her situation. I remember watching a documentary where they were talking about forced marriage. And so many times we tend to think about certain institutions from our own ethnocentric lens. And that means we look at it from the standpoint of the time period we live in and the society that we live in. Okay. So if you're wondering what ethnocentricity means, I know today is becoming one of those days where pronouncing things ethnocentrism. Okay, so this is a term rooted in social science and anthropology, as well as in colloquial English discourse. And it just basically means to apply one's own culture or ethnicity as a frame of reference to judge other cultures, practices, behaviors, beliefs, and people, instead of using the standards of the particular culture involved. So I wondered at one point, like within countries where there's a lot of forced marriage and the women have no power, like, you know, why would a father, you know, force his daughter to marry somebody and then, you know, she's getting, you know, bruised and beat up? And then I happened to be looking at this documentary where the girls described that their fathers, you know, whenever they decided they didn't want to cooperate, the fathers were chasing them down with hammers. Now, I'm going to say this. You tend to live, you know, until you decide to do things different, you tend to live what you learn. So if father is abusive, he's probably going to be not so picky about his daughter ending up with a man who practices similar behavior of his own. One thing that I can say, as I've been doing, you know, hashtag activism and talking with different women on the internet, which I plan to continue to do, as I've said before, when it comes to the whole fight for women's rights, everyone's fight is going to be different. Just with Black women alone, as you expand your horizons and follow influencers that may be Black, but maybe they're from the islands, or they're from Africa, or they're from other places around the globe, you find that many of them have a different fight that they're fighting. And if you're a born-again Christian like me, this is where that prayer life comes in handy. You know, or talking to different Black women everywhere and finding out that all of our battles are different. We are all each fighting a different battle when it comes to fighting for women's rights. Someone may be in a country where they're fighting for the right to be able to have a driver's license, something that we in America take for granted. They may be fighting for the right to go to school and get an education, something that we can take for granted. Now, let me say this much. our fight to be able to, even though our fight to continue to do these things pretty much wages on. Okay, it really doesn't stop. Even though we seemingly have not had to fight about those things in a very long time, as you can see with the Roe v. Wade thing, there are those people who are pretty anxious to snatch those rights. Now, even though I personally am not a proponent of abortion because of my own, spirituality, I choose to stay pro-choice. I can't be pro-life because there's too much going on over there. And many people, I know I'm umming a lot, but I don't care. But I think a lot of people don't realize the agendas behind some of this religious right and the ignorance that a lot of religious cults, like everybody that's on the religious right, is not a mainstream evangelical. Within those groups, you also have the Mormons, you also have Jehovah's Witnesses, you also have people that are groups that are considered to be cults by a lot of mainstream practicing Christians. And you know, you don't know what all they've been taught about a whole lot of things. So you have to think about that too. But as, you know, this war rages on, you know, the next podcast that I'm going to do, I think I'm going to do it tomorrow because of it being evening right now where I am. But I'm going to talk about feminist activities within hip hop. One thing I talked yesterday, and I talked about feminism's effect on society. And there's been a lot of positive effects, depending on where you are with that. It's like I said with the whole thing of the black troublemaker. Okay, trying to get somebody else to recognize that they've been very far removed from their own people. Many times, feminism causes women to examine exactly where they are in society. Now, you know, I talked about white feminism earlier this week, and the criticisms that many black feminists have of white feminism. White feminism is not necessarily a compliment. It's basically, you know, someone claiming to believe in equal rights, but really they're racist. Okay, we just go keep that honest. Because there are people that I don't consider to be, quote, white feminists. I just consider them to be feminists. And that's because those people that I like that are white and happen to be feminists also have done a pretty good job of reaching out to women of color and been very inclusive of pulling us in and uniting with us in this fight. So that's why I don't consider them to fall under that umbrella. So I'm going to go ahead and get off here. The next podcast is going to be a bit of a continuation of this podcast because we're talking about feminism in hip hop culture. So, as before, when I talk about black feminism, this is sort of a subculture because now we're talking, you know, almost exclusively about women in hip hop and the challenges and the fights that we still have to fight. One of them is representation, because when people think about their top five, they're still overwhelmingly male. In a whole lot of the subgenres, there's, you know, not a whole lot of female representation. And, you know, you also have to think about the fact, do you want to be represented in every genre? You know, if you do decide to be represented, how do you want to be represented? How do you want to be put out there? And that's something to examine. So I'm going to go ahead and get off here. I love everybody. I will talk to you in the next podcast. This is, you know, me blowing a kiss to you, and I will see you in the next podcast. Hello, you have reached the message line for Adam's Rib Media Ministry. If you would like to give me a shout out, recommend some topics for discussion, or give an opinion about some topics that I've already discussed, either here on my podcast or on my blogs, leave me a message and I will get right back to you. Have a blessed day. Bye-bye.